Okay, so it's not a formal meeting, it's a work session. We're focusing on the HPC, the Heritage Preservation Commission online training. Jane Beisel has agreed to facilitate it for us from her perspective of being, I don't know what to call it, certified historian or what you call it, as identified by the Secretary of Interior standards.
Yes.
Which I really appreciate, and I think I'll put it to you, and I think we'll close the door. Oh.
We can close.
Yeah, close the door, because Gail will know to push it open.
I am a Rochester resident and a small business owner who works in the field of heritage preservation. I am not knowledgeable about every aspect of it, but I know enough to know who to ask. I'm a contract historian. We do exhibit development. We worked with Mark many years ago. Probably a decade ago.
That's the exhibit I saw when I was out there, yeah.
We got a couple exhibits at that time. But so we do.
In the book.
I do curatorial work and National Register work and tax credit work, et cetera. So this is your session. I'm not here to teach you. I'm not a pedagogue. But we will walk through the pretty comprehensive online training that. State of Minnesota is providing for all the HPCs. This is something that was initiated by three HPCs in the state. And Christine, perhaps you remember which ones they were.
It was Red Wing, Mankato, and Stillwater.
Okay. They banded together and got a partnership grant from the Legacy Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds.
Right here.
And they presented this. They hired a curriculum developer out of Colorado who's experienced with this type of material, and they presented this online course and companion manual at the State Historic Preservation Conference last fall. I saw their presentation and was just thrilled because I think it's something we're all volunteers in this room, and not all of us. But everyone at the table here on the HPC is a volunteer, and can't be assumed that we will all have the same amount of knowledge coming to the table. So it's nice to have this sort of very general and very comprehensive overview as a point of departure. So,
and I think of interest is that the SHPO person, State Historic Preservation Office person, who worked with the three towns on this is Michael Koop. And Michael Koop is the SHPO staff person who... The draft preservation ordinance task force that was put together with members of the HPC and some outside members, with Dave Pedersen leading it, Michael Koop sat on that task force. So he's very familiar with this and with the ordinance and back and forth.
Michael Koop has been involved with Rochester for quite some time, actually. He wrote the designation study for Pill Hill Historic District when he was a lower rank staffer. And he collaborated with the predecessor, the Heritage Preservation Committee, which was a mayoral committee, talking to us and bringing us up to the level on ordinances. was very helpful to us, and I'm sure he'll be helpful to you going forward. So let's move. Christine, I'm going to take the clicker. And
That's not the clicker?
That's a recording of our meeting.
Ah, I won't.
Is there a clicker, or does she have to tell you to click?
Okay.
He's the clicker.
Okay. He's the clicker.
Hey, you. That's his command.
Let's flip to chapter 1. We're going to set up 2 and 3 as our targets today.
Okay, chapter 2 is on page 39.
So we need to go backwards. 32 pages.
So divided by 4.
So while we're... in digging any deeper into some of these topics, I would recommend a sort of a general, another broad-based but much more detailed resource that discusses HPCs and some of the basic concepts of historic preservation. It's very accessible. It's not a technical.
Grant, can she give you that to write down as a potential resource?
Sure.
Because, again, the ordinance, that's one of our charges, is to create a library.
Yeah, I would recommend this for anyone who's just starting out in the field of heritage preservation. And here's some of the terminology but doesn't know where to go with it. Okay, legal foundations, and I'm so thrilled that Pat is here.
Come up closer, bud. Please?
As far as where? I want to be able to plug in.
Well, can't you plug in at one of the... Do what you want.
I don't know. Oh, I guess I could.
It's just, it's going to be hard to yell back.
So, here we're just going to follow AUT, and we'll just basically read along together, and where there are questions or issues that we want to talk about, we'll discuss. This is not a historical overview of how the laws have evolved, which is in Chapter 1. Chapter 2 talks a lot about basic procedures, and it talks about things that would come up in an HPC member's duties, interfacing with the public. And then in the manual, there are some handy little... a little sidebar with places you can go online, resources that you can check out. So, Brent's page ahead. Here's an example question someone might ask you, asking about the city's right to designate and what these laws are founded on. So let's go ahead and see what their answer is. It is something that's been tested in the courts. Basically, if you look at Chapter 1, you'll see that there have been laws evolving since the 60s, really, and especially in the 2000s, laws for local designations have gotten a lot more precise. We have a enabling legislation in Minnesota law, and that's what our Rochester ordinance is based on. Let's go ahead, another one. So basic elements of a preservation ordinance, and hopefully these are all local ordinance, statement of purpose, how the rules of the preservation commission, what their duties are, what the criteria for designation are, how in general, how the process will work, and various ways that the commission can choose to act when faced with a heritage preservation question. I've noticed in the manual that there was a nice little thing that was very specific for HPCs. It's on page 40 of the manual. Rules of procedure, and I believe that you are pretty much doing these things, but you have a schedule for when your meetings are, and you have attendance requirements. Perhaps for the menu, for the members, and you have a set procedure.
Brent, do we have a maximum of excused absences?
I don't think so.
I don't think we do.
I don't think it's in the ordinance. I don't remember it's
not in the ordinance, but there's a
City policy.
Yeah, absence. We call it that as offhand, but there is a policy that has adopted.
Okay, we should probably send that out, whatever the policy is, so members are aware of it. Otherwise, they can't act on it. Thank you.
80%.
Thank you, Mark.
And does that include meetings like this? This isn't a required meeting, is it? This is just
a work session would not be counted. It would be scheduled.
Yeah, because that would be kind of getting to be a hardship if you kept calling unforeseen meetings. So, process for public comment, public hearing, decision making, etc. That's worth giving a look at at some future time. But let's go on to the next one. Key principles for preservation of ordinance. Due process must comply with the relevant state laws, which would be our state enabling legislation, and must be universally applied. That's what I was talking about. I guess it is in the online version. Okay, let's just keep moving. There are so many of these slides that unless someone has a question.
And Pat, please feel free if there's anything you wish to address specifically.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I should have said that at the beginning.
It says receive staff comments. How do you, who is the staff? Is that
I believe
that
you're not staff, you're volunteers. So. Yeah. So it would be Pat and Brent, we're staffing, if I understand that correctly, we're staffing the commission.
That is correct. I think Christina has asked our office if we would prepare a staff report on these hearing items, but the intention is that the hearing that we have is staff would present our staff report on the item, and then it would go to the applicant for their testimony during the public hearing process.
So I think that's pretty typical. You do that for the council, for instance.
Thank you.
Okay. No questions, we should move on. This is fairly obvious. Again, same procedure as the council might use.
Can I make a comment on
yes.
that?
Yeah.
And so this body has criteria to apply to each individual situation that is presented to you. And what the case law needs from a body such as this is rationale why you are deciding to approve or why you are modifying. If you're modifying, it has to be connected specifically to that project and with some specificity to it. And if you're denying it, then you would probably say it doesn't meet any of the criteria. But there needs to be some rationale. Because if not, it's a very appealable decision. It, they use words like capricious and fanciful and without any kind of merit. So as long as you tie your motion, whether it be approval, denial, whatever, with some of the criteria that is in the ordinance, then that is the rationale that you need. Now, when we do planning commission meetings, the staff typically would say, we're recommending that it be approved because of these criteria, and they provide that. It does not mean that the body has to go along with anything that the staff says, but it's a starting point. And so I think most of you have seen some of these meetings, either televised or been present or whatever, but typically after staff is given information, everybody has testified, and at that point the public hearing is closed, that's when there's discussion among the members. And oftentimes, someone will indicate, I want to bring a motion, the motion is seconded, and then there's all sorts of discussion about that motion. Sometimes if people, bodies are just on a bubble, they just can't really seem to make any movement, someone will bring a motion to either approve or deny simply to get the discussion going. If it's a tie vote, it fails, and then we need another motion and a second and discussion. During the discussion, if something comes up that somebody needs clarification from staff, I couldn't remember exactly what Brent said or what page was that on again, you can ask staff. But you can't be talking to the public unless the public hearing portion is reopened again. So just a little procedural that, and I don't know if anything that prompts any questions or not.
Can I ask if this is something that it's not covered in such great, wonderful detail as you just gave us, but that's in Chapter 3 when they talk about the criteria. But what they're saying is that the decisions that come out of the HPC have to be legally defensible and they have to withstand public scrutiny. Do you produce sort of a written summary of the rationale? Is that something that is the end result of the meeting, or is it just the minutes?
I believe Brent would be doing that, wouldn't you? About a decision and rationale?
Usually it would be in minutes only.
Okay, minutes only.
At least it has in the past.
Okay.
Change that.
Well,
Does that mean, so if we were, you know, we did this with one property, we did one group and said, yeah, we agree it shouldn't be on the list, and we all verbally articulated our reasons for voting that way, should that have been formally documented? For the following reasons, this property was taken off the list? Or is that, it's recorded, that, so does that, you know, would that be a supplemental?
The person that brought the motion, I asked him to give a couple of reasons.
Yeah, right.
Which he did, so that was
enough. That was enough then, okay, gotcha.
And so, I will tell you that this ordinance...
You'll help prompt us when we fail to do that, I guess. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot to be thinking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. People are trying to remember a question they want to ask when the time is right, and... or they lose their space because they were listening to somebody else and going to that page, and so a lot is going on. So it happens all the time, and that's kind of what I'm here for.
It sounds like, though, the key would be that the motion be proper, you know, if the motion provided a rationale, that needs to be documented in the minutes and how then, you know, the motion was for the following, whatever it is. Or do we rely on the recorded elements, too, you know?
Well, we're kind of...
The verbal, the audio recordings, is it?
These are the first public hearings that we're having, and we are probably all aware now that there's a high probability that they could be appealed. So do we need to formalize it more than we have in the past? Perhaps we do. Again, we know right now that rent is temporary, and so... discussion about does it need to be formalized and how formal does it need to be. We always have the recording, we always have the taping if we're doing it in here as well. The ordinance will be changing again. I know that one of the issues is there's no time frame for when someone can appeal. You know, 4 years from now somebody could appeal something at this point because it's silent. There was nothing about format for the appeal. There was nothing about cost for the appeal. So there's where it's a living being, it's constantly being tweaked to become better. So I am aware that in December, the city attorney, Terry Atkins, will be asking for some changes to the ordinance that hopefully will only make it better for you. But what he is looking at would not change criteria. You're not going to learn something new again. Does that answer the question? As far as how much are we documenting it? Really, I guess it depends if the body makes requests for more formalized written outcomes with regard to these public hearings. And then again, the staffing time and whether they can meet that in administration. I can't speak for that. This isn't the only thing that Brent does.
Yeah.
But some weeks it feels like it.
And as I understand, the only body that I know that asks for findings to come back in written form is council. Is that true, or do other bodies?
The Planning Commission has that.
They do have the written findings coming back to them.
Mm-hmm. A lot of their decisions, though, are for approval or denial with final decision by council. And so they say, these are the findings we're making that support our motion for approval. And the council does review that. Whereas you are the deciding body with regard to most things.
And so, in my opinion, that requires written findings.
And to do that, that means that you all need to become eloquent with regard to...
And we'll look to staff to help us become eloquent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe after a dry run with this sort of documentation presented, people will be more boilerplate. You know, people will have a sense of, well, this is what we need to say. If this is how we feel, this is the verbiage that the ordinance has put forth, and we want to make it consistent with that. And then if the public were to see, I'm thinking about the publicly accessible here, if the public were to see an opinion, even if it was a short opinion, they would have a sense of knowing what the rationale was, and this whole idea of it being capricious.
Oftentimes when it's organized that way, too, it's easier for people that don't work in this realm to be able to decipher the information, and then if they consistently see it in the same form, mm-hmm. they see, okay, they did cross all their I's, mm-hmm. or cross their T's, dot their I's, and this is consistent.
Yeah, consistency creates comfort. So, okay. If there's nothing more, let's move on. Okay, they're addressing somewhat of what I just asked about, the recording of decisions.
Do we post, planning and zoning now asks that a sign be posted? Is that true for rezoning or other things? This mentions a sign posted at the site, which is not something we've ever talked about.
No, for zoning applications, they're required
to post it.
Post,
yeah. But that's the only one in the city that's required to post it in physical form.
Correct.
Okay. They have their heritage, their historic inventory form.
Yes, and this is basically, we're talking about the beginning process of surveying here, of inventory, which is surveying. The Stark study was the first step in doing a survey. It was a sort of a mega survey, a survey of previous surveys, an assembly of everything that had ever been studied in Rochester, as near as anyone could determine, and that was funded with a Arts and Cultural Heritage grant, which is available for any future work he would want to do, just as an aside. And then 106 Group would have taken that a big step further in terms of surveying a specific area in downtown Rochester. And so this is an example, and I guess don't seem to have the 106 Group material here, but
you've all seen it. The forms that have been
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the 106 and the PBM will look differently because they have different ordinances they were working under. But we specifically asked PBM to put it in a format that's similar to the ordinance that the group is using now.
Okay.
And the criteria were exactly the same. Between the two ordinances.
Those
yeah.
Five or six, whatever.
Yeah, they were exactly the same criteria.
Okay. Now we're going to move into the whole designation process, and the adopted standards that are recognized nationally, those are the standards that were established by the National Park Service. Those are the National Register standards, and all the other standards that are used locally in communities are not identical, but based on a similar framework of terminology and criteria. So I think we explain this in the interest of lines. So, yes, these are things that you're sort of familiar with from looking at the 106 Group's work, which, you know, typically it's not phase one and phase two the way your relationship with the 106 Group has been, but a lot of these things that are being presented here are more the characteristics of what in Rochester has been a phase two study. A lot more detail than the windshield survey that 106 Group did first. Typically, it takes quite a few years to do a survey, an inventory. It's an ongoing process, as you know, as the idea of old starts to kind of, and historic starts to move up with the passage of time, there's always something more to look at, and historical knowledge evolves and becomes more comprehensive, and suddenly people have a new understanding of properties that have been perhaps on an inventory for a long time. So two of the gatekeepers, if you will, in terms of the criteria and review of professional work that are done, that is done, are the National Park Service and the Minnesota State Historic Preservation Office. So here's your survey that you are working on right now. We have a lot of the basic work done. Let's move on. Criteria. And this question of integrity here is really important. It's something that any professional study you ever commission from a consulting historian or a preservation firm will certainly give you a breakdown like this with the 7 different aspects of integrity, and they all have a very specific meaning. I brought a handout here that anyone who chooses to can get online. It's from the National Park Service. How do you evaluate the integrity of a property? Explaining in detail what these 7 parameters are. They don't typically all come out good. Even in the National Register level, they're not always good or excellent. You may have some fairs and poors with a prevailing assessment of usually at least good.
Might it be helpful? Jane's company worked on the National Register application for the Conley Moss Blue Duck Building. Might it be helpful to sort of use that as an example to talk just briefly about what each of these integrity pieces means?
Okay.
Because that received the listing. And
yes, thinking about that building, which I think most people, probably all of us here, are familiar with. It had excellent integrity of location. Typically, most properties do. It's not been moved. Design had good to very good, I would say. It's a little complicated for National Register because they kind of prioritize the facade, and they look at certain aspects like the flow of traffic inside the building, whereas you may lose some of the small decorative elements. They will be satisfied or happy if the building itself still has the feel of the historic building. Integrity is the ability of the building to convey its significance. So in that case, that building looked like a plumbing and heating firm. It's got the big mosaic tile floor at the entryway. It says plumbing and heating. And that was put in by the Moss and McCandrick Plumbing and Heating Company. Even though it was the Conley Camera Company before that, which was a very nationally important story as the exclusive and first supplier of cameras for Sears Roebuck, a major employer in the city of Rochester, etc. The building no longer had integrity if we were going to look at that context of significance, because we were able to document that the Moss and McAndrew Mechanical Contracting Company had a great history with Mayo Clinic and collaborative projects that they worked on with Mayo Clinic. The plumbing and heating story that the building conveys very well gave it good integrity overall.
And the point is you have to pick a period.
Yes.
Which I think is perhaps new to some of the people here.
You had a period of significance, and I think when we get on to significance, they'll talk about that. But the two are kind of related because the integrity, it's not structural integrity as you might consider with if you were an engineer. It's not the building. The ability of the building to stand up, per se. But if the building were in such poor condition that it was not didn't have structural integrity, you might have some difficulty with some of your other areas, but that's not specifically addressed in a historian's understanding of integrity. So location setting was pretty good. At the time, we still had the former Rosie Bell building right next to it. If you look at it. It was still surrounded, you know, closely with the same buildings that had surrounded it in the past during the period when it was important. The design and the interior had been filled up with a lot of temporary partitions and whatnot, but those were removable, and the original interior design was virtually intact. It had very good integrity in the interior as far as design. Materials, likewise, if you go back to Moss and McAndrew, it had the cast iron columns at the front facade. It had the original prismatic transom windows at the front facade. It still had the post and beam framing materials that it had. You still had the wood floors that were original to that time. It still had the freight elevator that was original to Moss and McAndrew's use. Still had, in fact, some original storm windows as well as original windows. And so the current owner was able to remove the inappropriate replacement windows, aluminum storm windows, and prefabricated double hung windows, and have the original materials that were left, the original windows that were left, replicated, so that although some of them are new windows, they do replicate the original. And so the feeling and association areas of significance were very high and were not damaged by the new materials that are in that building. Still looks very much like it did in the Moss and McAndrew day. So it's a good project. So you have a lot of different kinds of criteria for significance. Again, integrity, different thing from significance. Integrity is conveying significance. Significance would come from your criteria that are in your ordinance. I forget what they all are, but you have, I think, A through G or something.
And, I think it's A through H.
A through H. Association with historic events and trends is a couple of those criteria make up that bullet point there. And the association with individuals who made a demonstrable and lasting contribution, I think that's almost verbatim one of your criteria. Architectural merit is, not to dwell on that last decision, the last property that came up ahead in front of you. Architectural merit was the criteria for that building. 106 Group's findings on that is that it met whichever criterion it is that has to do with architectural style. They felt it was the Dutch colonial style, very good, or good example of that. So that's a criterion. And then here's another one that is perhaps a little more general, but and is a little bit more relevant for archaeological findings, which is that you have some stuff, you're not quite sure what it is, but in time with other discoveries about history of the site, you may be able to interpret it. And usually that's the criterion for archaeological remains at a site. Okay, any questions on that? Okay. Historic contexts, you have those in the 106 group provided you. And there are undoubtedly some more. Typically those are an elastic category as more knowledge is amassed about the history of a place, more context may be developed. It takes a lot of scholarly work usually to document events or people that may have relevance to your historic buildings. And it takes a lot of time to process that and to integrate new findings perhaps that may have.
What do historical themes mean? We don't have anything like that in our ordinance.
Historical themes make up context. I'm not sure why they put it second to me. It's a hierarchical thing.
Okay. What is the historical context of the Conley Moss building, again, just as an example?
Historical context was, I believe it was association with people who are influential in our development. I mean, with science and with commerce and manufacturing were perhaps the themes, and the context was the Mayo story and the Mayo Conley, Mayo Moss collaboration.
So it was tied to Mayo's development?
Yes.
Okay.
When we're looking at a historical district, is that ever locked into a certain time period? That, I mean, each property is evaluated in its own thing as part of a larger collection?
Usually you have a single story. Well, I shouldn't say usually, but you do. You have a single context for the district.
Okay.
And you may have a couple different periods of significance.
Okay.
You may have, in a commercial district, you may have early commercial buildings from 1850 to 1890s, and then maybe something happened in your town that suddenly there was a great burst and a whole bunch of new types of buildings were built for a different purpose.
So you could have things where, okay, I got stuff from the 1890s and the 1920s are the context, and then these few odd ones in the middle may fall out of that.
Yes.
That even though they're old, or even older ones, maybe.
Yes, if they don't relate to the context, even if they're old.
But could that be used to exclude something from a district? Or from being historically significant on its own?
It would be a non-contributing member of the district.
Of the district. But could you say that, I still think that building from, let's say, 1890, it's outside of the grouping we had, the context, you could still declare it historical, just not part of that district.
But as an individual.
Individual, right, okay.
So it can be non-contributing to a district,
but
still potentially an individual nomination.
Yeah.
And again, we need to sort of keep our mind, we have local designation, National Register submissions are possible, but we're focused in great part on the local designation.
Yeah,
and it's the
right.
same It's the yeah. same matter.
Can I ask people to try to not talk over each other in case anybody wants to listen to this later? Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.
So here, this is sort of what we were talking about with the Moss and the Canyon building. Change is okay, but it has to be able to convey its story and to convey its significance. And once you have determined what the significance of the place is, what it's associated with, whether it be the architectural style or the architect, or the development in the community. Certain type of building was being built because of something that happened in the community, like in Rochester, hotels are a part of a context. And so if it no longer looks like a hotel, and it's not a matter of there being just something that's obscuring what would make it look like a hotel, you may have a problem. So this is attempting to show in a simple fashion
that the last one does not retain its integrity.
Right. The one in the middle, it's been altered, and it's fairly significant what they've done, but it's you can still see the predecessor elements in there.
Wouldn't it also be the ability to be able to picture what was there originally?
Mm-hmm.
It's been obscured in the third one, in the second one.
And it cut off the top. You know,
yeah,
too,
yeah.
Right?
They removed that whole cornice. I mean, there's a whole chunk of
yeah.
that's missing.
Yeah.
Well, in the second one, it could be put back to its original form
mm-hmm.
if you wanted to. But in the third one, it's like it's
yeah.
too late.
Yeah.
And in some cases, something like that, some of it may be behind and obscured.
Mm-hmm.
So that requires the investigation.
Right.
The Conley Moss, again, as an example, the lintel, the front lintel, is the original look, but is a recreated...
That cornice there?
Yeah.
That's a very large cornice compared to the original cornice. And I'm kind of a little surprised by it, but State Historic Preservation Office makes those decisions, and it's a very dominant feature, and it was always a dominant feature because there was a big sign on top of it.
But not that dominant.
Yeah, well, with the sign, it had a lot more of a presence than it would without the sign. But nonetheless, it was a small cornice, and now it's a big one. Whatever. Another thing is that if the new features are clearly distinguished as new, that's it's a lot more permissible if you are calling a different way. But if you try to make it, if you're putting in something that's been removed and you put in something that is conjectural, it looks like it might have been original. Whereas that cornice, really, in my mind,
it looks like it's the historic.
To me, it looks much bigger than the historic ones that I've seen in other buildings. It looks to me like it's, and it's also made of a modern material. It's like some sort of
polymer.
Synthetic, yeah, polymer type of stuff. That it's fairly clear that that's not the original one, and so that's considered permissible and appropriate, not inappropriate, shall we say.
Jane, how far are we through this?
I have to leave at 6:45 for another.
Okay.
I don't want to rush you guys.
Well, I'm just. And the second chapter is also important. So I just, Brent, could you know where we are in this?
See of this chapter, close.
Yeah, we've got a ways to go.
Okay.
So I think let's.
Okay. So here's a recapitulation of the whole process. This is telling you that there are two levels of designation. There's the level designation that you made your part of, and there's the National Register. And the two may coincide or they may not. So let's move on. You can easily, it's telling you that you can easily go online and see what's listed in your area.
That must be rare that you have a nationally recognized one that the local community doesn't want to recognize.
That's very unusual.
That was,
yeah.
You can see where a local one is significant to us, but no one outside of Rochester.
Yes,
there, but
and typically
vice versa.
That's the way it works.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, let's go to the next one. Okay, I think we've already talked about this. Now, this might be worth talking about because there's a general belief, and I think you'll find this is common in our community as well, that listing on the register somehow constrains you from being able to do what you want with your property, or makes you have to adhere to design reviews. Which is not the case at all. And National Register listing will enable you to get certain financial incentives, whether they be tax credits, or if you're a nonprofit, grants, or if you're a municipality, grants. you can demolish your building, as we can see by looking locally. The Mayo Clinic, original Mayo Clinic building, which was a National Historic Landmark, was demolished. And there's no recourse, there's no backlash, there is nothing.
At
the national level, yeah.
So a national designation can be less
restrictive,
than a
local
one.
Yes.
I never knew that.
Depending
okay.
on the community's
yeah, I knew that, but I never processed it.
Now, depending on the community's will, you know,
sure.
Every preservation ordinance is different, and so that's an attempt to kind of give local control.
Mm-hmm. But that's one of the reasons why we've taken the national ones and made them local landmarks as well.
Yeah, which is good. It saves you having to re-examine all of these things that have been so thoroughly documented. There is something, though, that if you have a property on the National Register and you have a project that is going to receive federal funding, like a big road project or a big housing project or some such thing, and that project, it's judged by someone, usually at the State Historic Preservation Office level, that there will be an impact or that there could be an impact. There is what's called a Section 106 review, which is how the 106 group got their name, because I'm sure they do a lot of those. And that's why on the Stark study, you have a lot of gas stations and you have a lot of properties that are up and down Highway 52 that are not historically significant when you look at them, but they had to do due diligence and at least list them and say, well, sign off on all of those different buildings that would be impacted, the fact that they were not historic. So.
And it's federal grants only, it's not
federal.
State grants. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now we're back to the legal side of things. Minnesota statutes and Minnesota enabling legislation, which is, they have a link to it, I believe, in the manual. So we can go on from that. And then these are issues, and Kathy will address this, but these are things that HBC should be aware of as being things that may come up in a hearing. Let's move on to the next one.
Pat, do you wish to say anything at this point?
I feel like we're not going to get through the material if we interrupt too much.
Okay.
Yeah. We could always come back to it in some future session, but
okay.
This is a general thing. The takings argument has... is something that nationally has been discussed and tried and looked at, and it's not something that's viewed as applicable to historic preservation legislation. Let's move on to the next one. I think it explains why. Because it would require something like on the order of eminent domain, where a property is seized and the owners are evicted, and there is no remaining use for the owners. So let's move on. And the due process is much more of an issue that would concern an HPC, I think. Following the ordinance, giving advance notice, and giving people the opportunity to have their say, essentially. So let's move on. Attempting to give you the tools to meet the situation. Okay, now come on, ordinance stuff. So I'm not clear, and again, we maybe don't want to belabor this, but in Rochester, we have not really decided what the process will be for filing a nomination with the HPC and who can do that. Is that something that's still open to discussion? Or,
I don't think it's limited at this point.
Okay. Great. That's good to know. So this would apply to you then. Okay. You can move on.
I think the steps that we have here are different from what's listed. I mean, the ordinance, it goes to the HPC, then it goes to the council. It doesn't go to the planning commission for their
okay.
review or comment on the designation.
Mm. Okay. So Rochester's a little different in that respect from the typical.
Does everyone understand the word inventory in this?
I don't know if I do or not.
Okay. We touched on this at the beginning of the previous chapter. And here we go. They're telling you.
That was the Stark one?
The Stark was step one towards
step
getting
one.
An inventory.
And then we did the...
This is step two towards getting an inventory. And also, I think the GIS overlay... the planning department did was a step in having an inventory, and the inventory would be a long list of properties that have been looked at with recommendations and findings, if there are any, and it's not typically a regulatory thing because it's not designation. It's not the same thing as designation. You have a list, and you may have some properties that are recommended for or eligible for designation. And maybe, you know, in Rochester, we have the whole language of potentially eligible, which is not really typical, but it, I think, was put in there as a way to move ahead more quickly than many HPCs might be required to do. So you have, you know, you have designated, you have eligible for designation, and you have not eligible for designation as being things that, notes that might be put on an inventory along with the address. So this is a inventory would be open to various staff, government, I mean city staff departments, and it would be something that would be available probably online. I've seen a lot of them online for citizens to look at so that people know what they see.
That template is familiar, so that must be a standard form.
That is the state inventory form. Yeah.
Which is what the 106 group used.
Yeah.
So it was, yeah.
Yeah. Buildings, historic district, there's probably objects or structures.
And Valerie is not here, but again, a site is such as the Indian Mounds area,
Indian Hills area,
mm-hmm. Indian Heights area.
Or really any of our parks, St. Mary's Park.
Right. So it can be, I think the term used is as property generally, because it's believed that covers both sites and buildings.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe our ordinance covers, I don't know about the maritime sites, but archaeological resources, I believe it's covered by our ordinance. Landscapes. Now, this is what we were just talking about. Mark was asking about how you deal with things that are not significant in a district. Okay, we can move on. So it's interesting that they address compatibility because that's an issue that I'm sure CUED would deal with, talking about infill properties. And it's something that's very desirable when you're putting new structures into a historic district.
On the historic district that we're looking at, which includes historic third,
mm-hmm.
there's one building in like the middle of that block that's not historic, but to me it seems like it's almost contributing because it's so respectful of the others around it. Its scale is exactly right. Can something that's newer actually be contributing? Can infill be contributing?
Probably not. But if you had a second context for some reason, I don't think third is big enough, and I know that building, and I'm not sure what you could tie it to, but if you could come with, you know, if you could come up in a more diverse group of buildings with a second, you know, like some buildings were contributing to, like, the Greek population in early Rochester, for instance, or something like that. That could be a context.
That's a whole
and
difference.
You could have an architectural context in the same district.
Mm-hmm.
And
but it looks like it could have been there.
Well, that building, I'm wondering, I think there is something that might be original about that building, but not very much.
Mm-hmm.
Integrity-wise, I think it's pretty challenged.
Yeah.
But,
no.
I think there's something there, but I'm not sure what.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's actually important to, there is something that might relate to your context, but it has such poor integrity, you can't really call it a contributing property. You can document its history, and I think it's valuable to do that. But it doesn't have the same standing as the other buildings that are contributing.
Look at that brickwork coming. It's a beautiful thing. I'm joking. I'm trying to find some merits of it. It's
okay.
The worst example possible.
Okay, look at this one. I think this one has
more. Oh, yeah, that's much better.
About age, but it's important when people talk to you to be clear that age is not the main, it's not the deciding factor. Not everything old is historic. There are historic properties and significant properties that are relatively new. And for a long time in Rochester, I would have cited the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. I would have cited IBM. But now we're over the 50-year threshold on those, and but it's not unusual for there to be a newer building that has achieved significance in a shorter period of time.
Something I also think is sometimes hard to understand is a building that seems nondescript or that doesn't jump out at somebody architecturally can be historically significant.
Right.
So if you could sort of touch on that maybe when some examples come up, that would be helpful.
There probably will be something like that coming up, because that is a common problem where it's not a pretty building, and people are resistant to the idea of designation when it's not attractive. They don't like it. But it does represent perhaps a significant architectural trend, like brutalism, for instance.
Yes,
Baldwin building.
And the Baldwin building, I would argue for the Baldwin building until I'm blue in the face, actually, but it may not be your favorite building, and I would perfectly understand that. It's not.
There must be a trend that buildings in the 30 to 40-year-old range are just universally not liked.
A lot of things.
And then
the
next generation says, there's some charm to that,
right.
And it comes back in vogue. It's worth.
There's something to be said.
So brutalism will have its day. It's not here now. Give it a generation.
70s are starting to come back into fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Fashion. Okay, let's go ahead. I think this is true here in Rochester that our ordinance is quite close to a lot of the principles that underlie the National Register. They say that they do repeat, but because you could look at each of these chapters independently of the rest and still get the points that they're trying to make. But we've talked about the aspects of integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, character-defining features are a little more persnickety. It's something if you are looking at a rehab and you are planning a rehab and you are going in front of an HPC to discuss your rehab, the question of character defining features would come up. It wouldn't so much be an issue for designation, but if you would want to look at the original building and you would want to look at the existing building and you would want to inventory the features about that building that make it stand apart from other buildings of its type. You want to look at the buildings that, if it's representative of an architectural style, what are the features that it displays that are characteristic of that style. You want to inventory all of those features. And here's examples of the categories that you would be looking at. You look at when you're doing your description and your inventory, these are the things that you call out. And then the rehab should not have a negative effect on character-defining features.
Would that also apply? You mentioned on the Conley Moss Blue Duck again the tile work
mm-hmm.
that was significant to that mechanical period of time, identifying the company and such. That doesn't come up in this sort of listing, but it's, yeah, I would assume that's a character.
I would call it materials.
Materials, okay.
And or it could be craftsmanship, actually, decorative elements.
Okay.
You would want to keep that. You would want to keep the wood floors. You would want to keep the timber framing. You would want to keep that prismatic glass in the front, transoms that I discussed. But you could do a number of things. I mean, that was pretty aggressive. There's a new passenger elevator. There's a stairway where there was none before. There's a kitchen right in the middle where there's never been any kitchen. There are lots of things that are being done, but yet it's still from the National Park Service and the State Historic Preservation Office perspective, still has enough of its character to find the features. They have not been removed, so stuff has been added.
But could be removed again.
Could be removed again.
Okay.
And upstairs, when that building was used since the 1930s as a fraternal organization meeting space, so there was a dance hall, there was a bar, there was all kinds of stuff, when before it had been a sheet metal shop. I mean, it was very different, but it was fortunately, the sheet metal shop had very little decoration, had no partitions from room to room, and so all the stuff that had been added could easily and without any question be taken out. And the original historic materials could be rediscovered and refurbished, like the skylights that were original and were not visible the way it had been before are now visible and enjoyed. So, anyway, there we go. Lot of vocabulary there, and there are some good references for vocabulary. I brought another book that I noticed the 106 group is using as a foundation. A lot of their work, and this is recommended by the National Park Service as well. It's kind of a great reference for an architectural style that pretty much everyone can understand, and it has a glossary and all that stuff. So, so scale would be a character defining feature. And here we go with the districts, volumes. Talking about contributing it versus non-contributing, talking about a diversity of different types of resources, two wharves, retaining wall, breakwater. And those are really good to itemize. I know the Southwest Neighborhood Association has got some concerns right now with a retaining wall, which was an integral part initially of a Harold Crawford design home. But the home was subsequently divided into different, more modern houses that are not contributing. And the SHPO very deliberately drew the boundary of the district, of the Pill Hill Historic District, right along the street, along that wall, you know what I'm talking about, Christine, and included that house, but not all of the wall, not all of the site, because it included some modern buildings, when actually, the owner would like to get, some consideration, would maybe like to look at different types of things that could be available for a listed property. But because of the difficulty of the wall being sort of neither fish nor fowl, and the property being kind of semi-modern, semi-historic, it's not good. You know what I mean?
And it's also complicated because the wall is in the right-of-way. It's not on private property.
So whose jurisdiction does it fall under? And it's so drawing the right boundaries are quite important. And I think personally think the Pill Hill boundary, it was done in the 70s, and some of the newer houses from the 40s and 50s were not considered eligible, so are not contributing or are outside the boundary.
I thought the Pill Hill district was in 1990.
Oh, okay. I think you're right, actually, now that you say that. It's more recent than that. So there still are some 40s and 50s places that are outside the boundary and have similar context. So let's go ahead and see what they tell us about this. Again, walls and fences, changes in land use, all pertain to what I was just saying. This is complex, and I think if you get to the point of trying to designate a district, you might want to call Michael Coop down and have him do a review and an update on this, or maybe there's a chapter that's a little bit more detailed, but I think some of your specifics, once you get to that point, you might want to have a person who really does this districts. Okay, we made it.
It's only after 6.
Right. Good. Can we do the whole book?
It's good to review, thank you.
Any questions? Okay, I'd like to ask if this seems like a good idea, and if perhaps we could set up a regular day of the month to try to do this once a month. So we could go back to chapter 1.
Go backwards?
Yeah, well.
Do chapter 1.
Or we could do chapter 1 tonight. That might be.
Yeah.
But before we do that, if this, I mean, the group at the working session was supportive of having these sessions.
Yep.
Does today work? Using a period of 5 to 7, hopefully, wrapping up earlier? And is there interest in scheduling this as a regular working session? I'm going to just sort of take it around the table. Mark?
That's fine with me.
Yeah.
Jamie?
Mm-hmm. I like 5 to 7 on Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Gail?
4 to 6 would be a lot better.
It was agreed for a lot of people that's a hard time period. So, I mean, we can aim for 5 to 6, 6:30. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, an earlier finish should be better for you.
Yeah.
I see.
Well, an earlier start she can
start
earlier,
yeah,
which
right.
Some people it's hard.
Yeah.
I go to a lot of meetings. It depends on which Tuesday. Sometimes I can make it, like today, I have 3 meetings all around this. I want to speak at 6:30 and another meeting is down the hall.
Okay.
But it just depends on the day. I do, though, normally prefer earlier, too, because I'd like to eat dinner, being diabetic, and sometimes 5 to 7 is a little tough. But 6 is okay, but 7 is a little hard to do that on another day.
Okay. Tassos?
5 to 7 works for me, especially in the winter months. The summer months change everything. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this was chosen because it's the HBC meets on the last Tuesday of the month.
Mm-hmm.
This is 2 weeks before, which, it doesn't cram it all into, 1 2-week period.
Mm-hmm.
Tom?
5 to 7 works for me, but we're in real estate. I'm pretty flexible, so 4:30 to 6:30 could be equal for me.
I agree with Tom.
Yeah. Well, just rearranging the time. That's all it
is.
Okay. What are we going to say? A diner speaks?
Yeah, that's right. Well, our schedules are just, we're unemployed every day looking for work, so that's
right. Okay, so maybe, we have eight of 11 voting members here, which is a substantial number. If there's, and I don't know if we could usually get this room at 4:30 on Tuesdays, the second Tuesday.
It all varies on the schedule.
Okay, so we can't. That doesn't can't come into our equation.
So can we get a room
with projection?
Doesn't the other room have that click check?
4 to 6 hours.
Was that room?
Busy right now.
They gave 4:30.
Do we have to meet here in this building?
We probably need the slide stuff.
We need to be able to have slide projection, and Brent is our staff person. So, no, I don't think we would have to, but we, in terms of the public notification, we'd have to note where we were meeting, and it would have to be accessible to the public if they wish to attend. Because even though this is a working session, even though it's a working session. It's a working session, guys, but it has to be posted as a public.
That's a great idea.
Well, I'm going to, I know there are different feelings, but right now, I think in terms of doing this, and thinking of doing it in December, given December's schedule, and the second Tuesday makes sense. And for now, let's just stick with the 5 to 7, because it's what was approved for our regular meetings.
It's easier for the public to...
Okay. Yeah, now, would you like to do chapter one?
Sure.
Thank you, Jane.
More historical, and giving you the rationale. Yeah.
Before we start that, I need to say, do staff members have anything they want to ask about or say at this point in time?
About what we're discussing right now?
I'm not directing what you would say.
I'm going to be sending you an important email tomorrow, so check it.
Oh,
okay.
All of us?
All of you.
Okay.
That sounds scary.
Yeah. We're fully asleep now.
All right, Brent? Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's see what they have for us.
I think it's worth simply going through some of those, because again, it's summarized in our ordinance, but it's not something, it's honestly not something we as a commission have ever talked about. Why do we do it?
Mm-hmm.
So if you could, yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know if I have something specifically to say about it, but I think the diversity factor here is quite important. In our community, preservation of historic resources could honor another kind of diversity, which is a lot of our new buildings are being built now for just one purpose or one sort of social factor, which is that we're sort of a giant medical center here, whereas our old buildings were built for a variety of different purposes by people of different ethnic heritages. People of different ages, you know, and individuals and, you know, larger companies. We've got, you know, still have a building from Montgomery Ward's downtown, and, you know, so small, large, lots of different things. And that's all something that, to me, makes it attractive and appealing to consider ways to incorporate that in the fabric that's being planned and developed going forward. So, livability, Christine, you're an expert in scale and livability and green and sustainability, and all those things are related to preservation, and this curriculum here wants you to know it. So.
Well, and there's something, if you ever want to look at it, the National Trust did a study a few years ago about small, big, old, you know, new, and basically studied a lot of different neighborhoods throughout the United States to see what the economic performance was of areas that were predominantly new buildings and areas where there were mixed old and new buildings. And in terms of like all these metrics, you know, in terms of age variation, 24/7 use, et cetera, the mixed communities with a mix of old, new, small, big, perform better on all these measures. So, I mean, and that's considered when there's been all the work done on downtown and the RDA, which I sat on for years and helped to form the whole livability component. Heritage, the mix of small, new, older, etc., is considered a big part of livability, which is why you're bringing up the word. The sustainability,
greenest building is the one that's already
that exists.
Yep.
Yeah, and part of that is what they've concluded is older buildings, because of the nature of the materials, the density of the materials, old growth forests, all sorts of things, perform as well as many of the newer sort of very highly designed energy performing buildings. Plus, what they do is they consider something they call embodied energy. And a building that is built exists. It has man hours that went into that construction, the making of the materials. They also consider that the materials that are used in the building have an embodied energy measure. So a building that is torn down is an energy deficit that, if you're talking about energy performance, you need to take into account. And communities are beginning to do that in terms of energy performance. So I think that's about it.
Yeah, not to mention the landfill factor.
Yeah.
We've struggled with a little bit is preservation incentive. It's never been clear to me what incentives we have to offer. And I'm fairly new, but I think we've struggled with that.
Yeah, it's an ongoing issue.
Well, there are a couple of things. There's a revolving loan fund, which is PVN has been working on for us. And Brent says that we will be getting an update soon.
Okay.
And that's major. There's some of the things we've sort of dropped, which we need to bring back, are the RDA uses the facade easement program, in which there are small grants that are given to do facade maintenance and improvements. And there are a couple of other things which essentially after, I did not wish to send it out till we sort of started going through this,
sure.
But I will send out a note about the incentives that have been looked at both by the committee that you sat on, by the HPC, it was doing a draft ordinance,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, has a lot of little pieces. There are other things that, these aren't specific to heritage buildings. Minnesota has something called PACE. Are people familiar with it? It's Property Assessed Clean Energy, and the Conley Moss McAndrew building used it. It is basically almost a no-interest loan to do energy improvements, which may be like constructing a roof, it may be doing a building system, like replacing the old boiler and things like that. And it's tied, it then goes into your property tax, and it goes with the property. And it has an amazingly low rate of interest. It's a great way to finance energy improvements on older buildings. And that's, Rochester has it as applicable to commercial buildings. This year they were going to begin to apply it to private buildings, to like residences. I don't know if that's happened. I don't sit on the Energy Commission anymore, but I can find that out. So that's, I mean, so one person commented, Jamie, was it you? Can you say, reading through this first chapter, one of the things you were surprised by?
Yes, were the number of things that people can, number of incentives that people can apply for.
National
grants and,
incentives.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff.
So this will cover more of those.
Okay. We're actually working on the PACE on one of our buildings right now.
It's amazing.
Really well. Yeah,
yeah.
It's amazing.
It's administered by the St. Paul Port Authority, which has great experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's going, it's just, I can't believe what's happening.
That's really great to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be nice if you wanted to, once that's done, if you wanted to sort of present that.
Testimony.
Just my own, I would love to hear about it.
Started out really small and I just kept saying, hey.
You could do this too.
I want to do this too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, how about this? You know, you should really.
I mean, you start out wanting to do one thing, and then they give you a comprehensive way to make your building more energy efficient.
So they have advisors who kind of look at your plan and make suggestions.
Actually, somebody came to us and said, hey, we'll help you with every part of it.
Inspected the building for you. So lighting, HVAC,
roof, materials.
Well, John Helmers of the county.
What's that?
Yeah.
Is IBM doing that too? Or no?
Oh, we've done some of that on our own.
But have you applied for PACE?
No.
But John Helmers at the county level is the person who has administered that. So it's administered at a county level. So it's not, I mean, I assume it's countywide. It's applicable in Rochester, but it's a countywide program.
Yeah, but it's not just our county. It's
it isn't
statewide.
Adopted in all the counties. It's not statewide. It's something that you have to initiate and adopt locally.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's just that the St. Paul Port Authority ended up being a good administrative agency who agreed to do it.
Now,
telling you there is an important point here, and that is about active use. It's not just the current model of preservation, and people who are in the field of preservation are focused not just on trying to keep a static moment in time, but in allowing these buildings that have something to say about our heritage, our past, and architectural history, and a variety of things, diversity, and all those other things, keep them in use and make them relevant to changing conditions.
The premise being you can't preserve unless it can be useful, or it doesn't have economic viability.
It's not as economically viable, and it's just, it doesn't achieve the objectives of preservation, which is to have people experience these buildings and continue to use them. I mean, it's no longer a sustainable practice. If you've got a building, you can say, oh, well, it's already built, and we're not destroying all these resources, but on the other hand, you're not using it, and you're probably replacing it with another building that you are going to have to use resources to build.
Okay. Jane, just one interjection here.
Yeah.
There are tax credits for non-historically designated buildings, too.
There are right now. Whether we will still have that after our tax bill goes through.
Okay, but let's not operate on the if,
yeah.
maybe,
right,
what.
As of right now.
Because I don't know that people in this group know that.
Okay.
So if you could just give a brief.
Are we going to get on to the incentives?
Yeah, you want to wait until that comes up?
That.
Okay.
Now we get to like a historic overview of legislation and private efforts to do preservation. We can skim through that. starting way back, 1853, and various small private nonprofit organizations have been founded, usually around one property of interest. And, you know, in Rochester we have Heritage Associates, and we have Friends of Maywood Residents and Historic Sites. That's started with just an interest in preserving one specific site. That's very typical. And in Minnesota, we have a statewide preservation organization that started exclusively as an advocacy group, is now a multifaceted preservation support group. I'm on the board of Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, and I can say without any reservation that Pam would be thrilled to step up and help you if you have any issues or want to do any partnerships or need a lecturer or anything like that. I think there's an interest in outreach for all the HPCs in Minnesota. So we look at the history then of preservation ordinances. They've been around for a long time. Someday they'll put Rochester on that list. I don't think we're there yet.
We're not an early one.
Yeah.
But we have an ordinance.
We do have an ordinance, yeah. They're still talking early. It's only going up to 85. So. That's the enabling legislation I was referring to earlier. Minnesota statutes that give the sort of basic framework for what individual communities choose to do as their own historic preservation ordinance.
What year was that enacted?
It's been revised.
Was it earlier? It was 1960 or something like that before? If you go back a few.
Just curious.
I think it was.
I think it says 1969.
69, yes, state of
Minnesota. There we go.
That may have been the start of it, and it's been revised since then.
Okay.
And I've got the 2017 version here. It's a one-page ordinance, and it's been revised. 71, 73, 85, 89, 2003, and this year, actually.
And our ordinance actually has probably already like 5 revisions on it.
I wouldn't be surprised,
When you say that, what, our local one?
Our local one. If you go to it and go to the bottom, all the revision dates are listed.
When was the last revision?
I think in May of this year, and I don't know what it was. It was perhaps a minor typo, I don't know.
Because what you were talking about, Pat, was there might be some changes based on what we learned. Would those come to us, though, at all, to review those proposed changes? Do they come to... No? No? Okay.
They're going straight to council.
They do? Okay.
Because they're not considered...
Well, little typo things would be one thing, but like...
typo things can be corrected.
Yeah.
Something like that can be corrected by staff, city attorney. But if it's something substantial, it's the city council that creates the ordinances and amends ordinances. So that's why it's not coming to you, any ordinance.
Would they, is it tradition that they might come to us? To a, say, hey, we heard this feedback. Either we give them the feedback or they come to us. Say, hey, we've heard this feedback and we want to make a change to get our input on it. Or they're not required.
It's more like a body indicates they're having difficulties with maybe some vagueness. Or
we might express it, or somebody else. Anyway.
Yeah. Or believe that another section that would further define this kind of action would be helpful. And then that is communicated to our office that does legal, and we look at that, and then there can be a proposed language change, and then that goes before council. And anybody can appear at council for support or not.
I guess as council, when that has happened, have they typically gone to the group that's impacted by that? Like, would they come to us?
No.
You think they would just do it themselves? It depends on the nature of it, if they're... gutting the bill, for instance, or changing the
whole
structure.
Typically, when somebody is interested in the change, it's communicated. And sometimes people will contact their council person or talk to the city attorney if there's some kind of filling in the blanks kind of a thing.
I'm just thinking of a scenario. What if we came to one of our regular meetings and, oh, by the way, last week they voted to get rid of you, and we didn't even know, or something like that, right? Oh, they changed the way things happened, or your meetings need to be structured differently. They don't have to formally engage us. They could do that, but
it
wouldn't be professional.
Your mercy.
Yeah. It wouldn't be professional, but they could do that, right? I mean, it should, a courtesy would be to say, hey,
But may we make a request to simply be emailed a version that's going to become before council as the standing HPC?
Because we might want to speak about it.
It would be part of a packet that goes out ahead of time.
If everyone on the HPC is being alerted to such things.
Yeah, looks for it,
Interesting. I can't answer that my office would do that. So right now my answer is I cannot tell you.
You cannot.
See, I would hope if it was something significant.
Yeah.
I would
say,
hope we
hey,
would
you
at
know,
least be alerted
in
to
this
courtesy.
Town, yes.
So that's simply, that's a general feeling.
Curriculum, but the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act was a significant development in a lot of things, but it impacts historic preservation because not only it protects not only natural resources but historic resources, and so that is sort of a lawsuit under this act is the sort of path of last resort, if you will, if something is going to come down without due process or with, and whatever reason you may wish to challenge a demolition decision, this is the enabling legislation for that. That happened most recently that I'm aware of up in the Twin Cities with PV Plaza. PV Plaza, which is on Nicollet Mall, it's a modernist landscape that hasn't been well maintained, really. And it's
not, a 1970s.
Yeah, and it's not
set down.
That's sunken one. Yes,
it's the sunken
one. Accessible,
and it had lots of water problems.
Yes, and has leakage or whatever, but it's not well maintained. And so there was a plan to do something completely different, not to preserve it. And an action was brought, or a legal action was brought under the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act. And the plaintiffs prevailed, and it's being restored, but again in a very loose way with better accessibility and
ramps. I imagine
it's complex, and yeah, it's actually something you can ask PDN about. PDN is one
that's
of the
yes
consultants on that.
Well about that.
But it's interesting they had to resort to that measure, that there was no one local, the local ordinance or whatever it is, to protect it in some way, shape, or form, that they could leverage that.
Good point. Yeah, I don't know.
They had to resort to this last thing.
Minneapolis HPC, I don't know what their view was on it.
Well, and it went on for a long time. I don't remember when it began.
City of Minneapolis, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's part of the park system.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. So. So, 44 certified local governments, including Rochester?
We're not certified yet.
You're not?
What?
I didn't know that.
Okay, the ordinance as written, as we understand it from Michael Koop, is certifiable. Again, we've had staff change, and Aaron was trying to get bios from all members, which was one of the requirements. And again, Brent is overloaded. We will seek that as soon as is reasonably possible, and it should be a fairly simple process. When we talk about incentives, this is one of the things where it's important, and that's because the big thing, the land, arts, all of that, that's available to anyone. You don't have to be, quote, a local landmark or whatever else, or a certified local government. There are many grants that are available through the SHPO office that are only available to certified local governments. So some of the work we do when we talk about like doing phase two and things like that, or looking at another kind of district, our HPC with assistance could be applying for those sorts of grants to aid the process of heritage preservation.
And you could apply even if you're not a CLG. You could apply for the legacy grants.
The legacy grants are open, yeah.
The STARC study was funded by a legacy grant.
So that is, that's an incentive we haven't talked about before, but the legacy grants, is everyone familiar with what those are? Okay.
Yeah.
And there's substantial funding available through those.
Very substantial, yes. Okay, let's go. Let's see what we get. So here we go with the history again. Starting in the 30s of trying to organize federal support for what these small groups were doing and what the sort of will of communities across the country was. We had urban renewal, which was not necessarily something that would prove to be long-term a friend of historic preservation, but it did have a strong impact, so we could move on. National Historic Preservation Act and the National Environmental Policy Act were sort of the turning point, if you will, into the modern of having the national preservation infrastructure that we have now with the SHPOs and the National Register, and I imagine that's going to come up next, but the things that we have now to support. That 1980, the CLG program that Christine was talking about, with the resources available for qualifying local programs.
Which simply means certified local government.
Right. Good. So here are the multifaceted, diverse responsibilities and roles of the HPC.
Is that all?
Well, I bet it's covered other places.
I'm looking in the manual right now. I went through last night on the other two chapters, and
we threw you a loop because you're so good at what you do.
Yeah,
just a single page here, and really, I guess that's all they need you to know right now. Okay. So, again, more arguments in favor of historic preservation and what the benefits are to the community. A lot of communities, I think, get more out of it than Rochester, economically, more than Rochester might care to get out of it, because heritage tourism is not something Rochester has ever really needed, because we have medical tourism here. But heritage tourism in places like Lanesboro, Wabasha, even the Twin Cities is a big economic driver.
But one of, again, in terms of identification, and we talk about the DMC. Within the DMC master plan, heritage in terms of the city being appealing for reasons other than medical was one of the items identified as important.
I don't want to dismiss it. Just been a difficult argument to make in the past, because
it's an important part of the patient experience, though.
It is. And the resident experience, too. Mm-hmm. I think it's, it enriches quality of life considerations, again, with the older, smaller, better, and scalability and walkability and things like that. All good. And here we have the embodied energy argument, if you will, and the sustainability, building materials, energy savings. There are studies out now that properly fitting historic windows with the old growth wood, very dense wood, and properly fitting storms are more energy efficient than the modern vinyl windows and whatnot that are often replacing them. So there's a lot of work on that.
Well, take old growth lumber.
Really, yeah. There's a lot of data on that now that's been circulated. Yeah, it's because part of it is that the vinyl windows are encasing another material, and they trap moisture. They rot. You know, they have a lifespan of only 20 years, whereas these wood windows, properly maintained, last a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the rest of the building is below. But people don't like to put up storms. That's another factor. So it's a challenge. So let's
see. Yeah, it's the cost of labor that.
Mm-hmm. Or.
It's the notion of scheduling maintenance.
To maintain this,
You know, the notion of low maintenance is
compelling, but it's quite expensive. So here are the incentives, and they have quite a bit on that I see in the manual, with a lot more detail about the new market tax credits. Suffice to say that these are not, except for the CLG, are like the second two are used for historic buildings, but they're not specifically targeted towards historic buildings. They're for blighted areas with low-income housing, which in some cases also corresponds to older areas of a larger city. They're often used, the new markets tax credits, for instance, that's 39%, and if you couple that with, I'm sure they're going to tell us next about the rehabilitation tax credits, which is 40%, and so that 79%.
So what is a new markets tax credit?
A new markets tax credit is described here.
Don't worry about it.
Did you find it?
26.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Community Development Financial Institution of the U.S. Department of the Treasury offers the New Markets Tax Credits Incentive as authorized by the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000. 39% credit is available for investment in community development entities. That's above my pay grade. That's
isn't that something that would be subject to some of the new tax legislations that are going through?
Yes, that's a probability. Yeah. So the development community is very up to speed on exactly what these are and how they can be used.
Well, do either Dan or Tom know people who have used this?
Not specifically for me.
Not specifically, no.
Where of them?
Some of the downtown, did Guster Feliz use this on any of his projects?
Yeah, he probably has. I mean, the tough part is whenever you're working in these projects is you're throwing a lot of things against the wall.
Yeah.
And not knowing which.
Which you're going to come.
Not staying engaged, not knowing which ones actually got funded.
I don't believe.
Mark, thank you very much.
I know people who are very knowledgeable about this that could come down perhaps and speak to you, but I'm not one of them. I just know that these are not, these are sort of adjunct programs that support preservation, but they're not specifically targeted at preservation.
Right.
Let's move on to the next one. The state programs are mostly the grant programs that we just talked about. Heritage grants, those have been around since 2008, and they're funded with a special sales tax. They're embedded in our Constitution. Available to nonprofits, cities, municipalities, good things for interpretation as well as academic work, like research, survey work, all that type of thing is fundable. The rehabilitation state tax credit is something that works hand in hand with a matching federal program that they're going to get to probably on the next slide, but it would reimburse, it can be used in a lot of creative ways, but it reimburses you for 20% of your covered rehabilitation expenses, and it would, the covered expenses are for converting a property for an income-producing use. It's not as appropriate for single-family dwellings. What else do I know about it? Anything that's basically attached to the structure usually turns out to be fundable, but if you're upgrading with new appliances or things like that, that's not fundable. Mm-hmm. But if it's an actual bona fide building investment, it is fundable. So it's 20% from Minnesota, and it partners with a matching 20% federal, and Christine will get to that old but not historic credit in the next slide, I'm sure. The grants in kind and the grants in aid, capital projects, are for municipalities. Heritage Partnership Program is another program that comes out of the sales tax revenue that typically would bring together two nonprofits or a municipality with a nonprofit to do something that a type of program that would not normally be part of their mission, would be a new type of programming fundable. Historic Recognition Grants Program, I don't know anything about. It's probably in the manual. I think it's could be for public programming about awards or something like that. I'm just guessing. It's probably in here. And I don't know anything about the Small Cities Development Program. Christine, you might?
Deed is complicated. I wouldn't
possibly
say. The department, I mean, I would, you guys, I mean, DEED is a complicated department. I can't summarize that.
Okay. Well,
hopefully it's explained further in the manual. Yeah.
In the manual. So some communities have local programs in place. Someday Rochester will be up there as of now. It looks like a lot of these are grants. Matching grants. Other potential incentives. We do a lot of this in Rochester with TIF, and you know, I don't know. Again, this is a development specialty.
Well, TIF is one of the things that was applied again to the Moss McAndrew building.
So, yeah, so that was a.
And it's been. It's there. Also being applied to the Armory building.
So easements, I know something about. Preservation Alliance of Minnesota is
is an easement holder for a variety of, and growing number, I would say, of historic properties. It's a way of ensuring private property owners can do it, listed National Register public buildings can do it, but it's a way of essentially giving away a portion of your building, the exterior, typically, sometimes only the front facade, to a nonprofit. And you can get a tax deduction for this. You conceivably could get a property tax consideration. You can get your property tax, the value of your property lowered, which would lower your property taxes, and you would also ensure that the exterior of the property would not be changed. It's actually pretty stout. I don't know of any case where anything has been challenged or overthrown or anything, an easement.
Doesn't that also come into play as far as taxes? It has a value
mm-hmm.
that then people use against their taxes that are due.
You're giving away
right.
To a nonprofit
right.
a tangible asset, which is the exterior or the front facade of your building. And the nonprofit is not going to use it for their own purposes, but they will, you know, periodically survey your property and, you know, make sure it's...
What kind of a nonprofit, though?
PAM, Preservation Alliance of Minnesota.
Oh, got it.
I think there are some other nonprofits nationwide that will do it, but in Minnesota, the big easement holder is PAM.
And the facade easement is another thing that the the Heritage Preservation Commission, in terms of looking at incentives, looked at. And I think Aaron has a rough draft on that within his file.
Are you thinking about doing facade easements?
It has not been discussed in the last 8 months.
Okay.
I mean, again, a lot of things happened and then were sort of put on hold as the ordinance was being revised.
Right.
And also there was a member, this was before I didn't join the HPC until not pretty recently, after sitting on the task force. But Chris Geisner, people will know, the group that's a community development group that does consultancies for small cities.
Oh, yes.
Chris worked with the city of Chatfield on their major restoration of the art center and other things. And he worked on it from a community development point of view that then works to figure out what all the financial benefits you can use are to maximize what you can do. And Chris was on the commission
mm-hmm.
and was the person who was very instrumental in starting to outline potential incentives that could be used. When the ordinance was substantially revised, the requirement was that you must reside in the city of Rochester, and Chris did not. So with the adoption of the ordinance in December, Chris stepped off in November, essentially.
Resources that can help, depending on the type of resource you're looking at, you might want to consult some of these folks. And then there are federal resources as well. And there's just a lot of information available online through a lot of these. The predecessor Historic Preservation Committee looked at the possibility of joining the National Alliance for Preservation Commissions, and I think we had our hands full and we just never did, but it would be something to do that might help you with some resources and education as well if you were interested in pursuing that. Let's go back one. And I would add to the previous statewide one, there is a statewide preservation conference. It's about a day and a half every September that does a lot of programming that's for HPCs. Last year it was September 13th through 15th or something.
And it's always in September.
Thursday and
okay.
a Friday. And the Friday is really only half a day. It was in Albert Lee this year. And
where is
the
it
Albert
next
Lee
year?
HPCs.
Where is it next year, Dean?
I wish I knew. It's online. I don't know. They do a lot of stuff. The organizers this year were the HPC of Albert Lee and the convention. potentially Visitors Bureau, combining with the, thank you, for, with the SHPO, State Historic Preservation Office. And they had a remarkable number of programs for HPCs this year. I was astonished. It was all about doing inventories and code compliance things and flexible existing building code and
right.
That can be useful.
Well, and that's where you first encountered this manual.
That is
it was presented
last
at last year's
yeah.
statewide training.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very friendly. They closed down the main street of Albert Lea and had a big dinner for us. They had a big barbecue and put banquet tables down the middle of the street, and we sat there and looked at the main street buildings and sunset and ate barbecue. And it was terrific. I mean, really friendly communities. So they're very welcome.
Yeah. What's the name? What is that called again?
Statewide Preservation Conference. It's on the State Historic Preservation Office website.
Okay.
So it's basically organized by them with the individual community that is going to host it.
Got it.
Yep.
Sounds like a field trip.
Yeah. That's three chapters.
Okay.
Out of what, seven or
something? Out of nine chapters, I think. There's nine chapters total.
So that means we only have two more sessions?
Yeah.
That's a good way to think of it.
Yeah.
So when is the next meeting?
Okay, let's look at the calendar. In December, the second Tuesday is the 12th. And I know this is presumptuous of me, but I already have it on my calendar. if that's it. So would people please add it? And Brent, could you send out a note to the full HPC tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So when would it be?
It would be 12th. December 12th, 5 to 7 potentially. But you could be here for the last.
I could be here for the last.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm glad to share notes that I took, well, although my notes are typically pretty cryptic.
Is that December
12th. It's the second Tuesday of the month.
Okay.
Jane, do you want to think about whether you might consider this? Made it very fluid, which was very helpful.
It's helpful. You know, like I say, this is pretty comprehensive. I'm just telling you to flip the page pretty much.
In my opinion, it frees the members to participate and to direct questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome.
And yeah. I annotated some of the notes that I took when I just read chapter one
with
the expertise that
yeah.
you have,
good.
So it was really helpful.
And I'm thinking
you
could put together a chart on the incentives, because you love doing charts.
I'm watching her.
Okay. So as facilitated by Jane, any questions, any comments?
It was a useful meeting.
Absolutely, there's so much to learn. No, it's in addition to...
He's Barry's asking about... Folks, I think we're still recording, so for 1 minute... Barry's asking about what Pat is sending out tomorrow and has asked, will that affect, are you asking about, will it affect our meeting on
this? I don't know how we actually have our meeting. I'm just trying to keep my schedule.
On November 28th.
Yeah.
I don't
know. We're going to have to wait a few more hours and read your email.
You okay?
It's like Christmas.
I will make one note that the meeting in December would be December 26th, which is the day after Christmas. So if I will ask that meeting.
So do we want to poll people to see if we go to the Tuesday after the 12th, is Tuesday the 19th?
We already had it scheduled for the 19th. I don't know why, but I already written it in there for that.
Works for me. Yeah, I can get the 19th.
So do you want to send out?
I'll have it in the next agenda.
Well, could you attend on the 19th?
Right now, yes.
Okay.
Same here, so the 12th is on?
No, the 12th is the training, but our regularly scheduled meeting would be moved from the 26th back to the 19th. And Brent, in the email, could...
I can go back and check the minutes.
And I don't have it on my calendar, but I can screw up easily.
I'm pretty sure, because I did write it in, so we must have talked about it at some point, but the point is, even if we have it.
Well, I mean, there's the question. This is a working session. We are recommending that. You're saying we can't act on that? We're not doing business. We're scheduling another working session because this is a work session group. So if you would send out the email inquiring, although can we act on it through an email or do we have to wait until our meeting?
As far as training?
No, as far as rescheduling the date of the meeting in December.
You need a regular meeting to do that?
Okay.
We're not going to have a regular meeting in order to do that.
We don't know. But I'd ask that people put it on their schedule to hold it, subject to discussion at a regularly scheduled meeting. Okay. Thank you. I don't think, since it's a work session, I don't think we need a formal motion or anything. We can just all walk out.
There is an anticipation there could be litigation with regard to one of the projects that's coming before you. And so just want people to be aware that if emails are sent over the city system and there's a request for emails that contain the project's name, we have to provide that. So if you put things in writing, be aware that they could be discoverable. It's not to say that you can't write about something in used terms, but you can always pick up the phone too. That's a good alternative if you would like. Okay, so just keep that in mind.
Explain that again.
I understood it, so I'm
going to
go.
I did. Bye,
Todd. Yeah, thanks.
There are situations where there is potential litigation. Legal counsel that represents the party that is considering that can ask for emails between a certain date and a certain date with specific terms.
Between anyone on the commission and...
No. This with the government or city website. So any of you all writing in, me writing out,
email.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we keep those
but
on the
it's
server.
Not specific to members, it's specific to keywords.
Specifically they ask for keywords, and yes, they do limit it sometimes to specific people and dates. So I want you to be thinking about that. If you have something important you want to discuss, but you want it to be more private in nature, maybe putting it in writing isn't the best idea.
Got it.